we don't get too far behind in keeping up. But the question that we're going to deal with this evening, what are the Nephilim in Genesis chapter 6, 1 through 4, and Numbers 13, 33? Well, Genesis 6, 1 through 4 was just read to us. Let's go over to the only other time the word Nephilim, to my knowledge, is used in the Old Testament. And this happens to be when the men of Israel were sent to spy out the land. It's kind of beeping and coming on and off. Okay, well, we'll see what happens with that, I guess. Numbers chapter 13 and verse 33 is after they had come back, the 12 spies had been sent to spy out the land, and they came back, and they gave this report. There we saw the giants. The descendants of Anak came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in their sight, and so we were in their sight. So who are these Nephilim? Who are these giants? Actually, only the King James and the New King James translate the word Nephilim as giants. Everybody else just calls them Nephilim, which is fine. That's just a transliteration, making the Hebrew word an English word. But I'm not sure anybody knows what it means. So it would be helpful to have a translation. Notice that it says that they were present in those days, Genesis 6, 1 through 4, and afterward, probably referring to after the flood, where we just did see that they were mentioned in Numbers 13 and verse 33. So there were giants in the earth prior to the flood, and there were giants after the flood. Where they came from, we'll talk about just a little bit later, because that's an interesting observation, and there are some theories concerning that, and we want to deal with that. However, there's another word that is translated Rephim, and that also is giants, and sometimes the King James will translate it giants, and sometimes they'll leave it as Rephim, as do other translations. Now, this word is found a number of times. The earliest one is in Genesis chapter 14 and verse 5. So let's take a look at that one. And in the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim in Ashtaroth, Carnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shaveth Kiriathaim. Now, these are all different locations and all different names for giants. We'll come back to that point in just a minute. Let's also look at Genesis chapter 15 and verse 20. And while we're doing that, we'll show some pictures up here. Chapter 15 and verse 20. It's interesting that we have people that are this size, is it not? 8'11", and even a woman of great height and stature, even today. And here is the tallest family. I don't know who that shrimp is in there, but the rest of them are pretty tall, as you can see. But anyway, Genesis chapter 15 and verse 20. The Hittites, the Perizzites, and the Rephaim. And this is referring to their height, the fact that they are giants rather than a location, although they were located in the promised land. So these two words are translated as giants. Now, let's take another look, though, at some other places that we find. 2 Samuel chapter 21. 2 Samuel chapter 21. And This is also the case in 1 Chronicles, but we're not going to read both passages because they're fairly identical. The one is a repetition of the other. 2 Samuel 21 and verse 16. Then Ishbi-benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, who was bearing a new sword, thought he could kill David. And then we go on down to verse 18. Now it appeared afterward there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. And there's a couple of others who were one of the sons of the giants. All right. And then verse 20. Yet again there was a battle in Gath where there was a man of great stature who had six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in number. And he was also born to the giant. And the word there is Rapha, which is the singular of Rephaim. So those are some various passages. Again, we find the same thing in 1 Chronicles chapter 20. Isaiah mentions the valley of Rephaim in Isaiah chapter 17 and verse 5. The giants are known by other names in other places. The Anakim, which were in Palestine, in the Promised Land, were also called by other names. They were called by the names of Emim by Moab, Zuzim by some, and Zamzumim by the Ammonites. And we already looked at Genesis 14:5, which made mention of some of those other names. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. Deuteronomy 2, beginning with verse 10. The Emim had dwelt there in time past, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. They were also regarded as giants like the Anakim, but the Moabites called them Emim. So there you have a specific delineation. These are the same, but as these tall individuals, these giants, they were known by one name in one culture and another name in another culture. So they are called the Anakim. They are called the Emim by Moab. And then Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 20, that was also regarded as a land of giants. Giants formerly dwelt there, but the Ammonites call them Zamzumim. So different names by different cultures, all referring, however, to giants. Next, we want to go to another passage in Deuteronomy, chapter 3 and verse 11. In this passage, we see, for only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants. Indeed, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. Is it not in Rabbah of the people of Ammon? 9 cubits is its length and 4 cubits its width, according to the standard cubit. Now, a cubit generally was regarded as a foot and a half long. So a bed 9 feet long was 13 and a half feet by our measurement. And 4 feet wide would be, four cubits wide would be 6 feet wide. You know, most people sleep on a bed that's 6 feet long or something close to that. But imagine that. Now, that doesn't say he was 13 and a half feet high, but his bed was 13 and a half feet long. He may have only been 10 feet high. Who knows? Or if his feet hung over, he might have been 15 feet tall. Who knows? But nevertheless, he was and had the biggest bed that I've ever heard of for someone to sleep in. But there, Og was defeated by Israel. Sihon and Og were both defeated prior to their getting to the promised land. Let's also notice verse 13. The rest of Gilead and all of Bashan, the kingdom of Og, I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh. All the region of Argob with Bashan was called the land of the giants. And again, that's the word Rephaim. All right. Now, we're still not through with those because they get a couple mentions later on. So let's go to the book of Joshua, chapter 12. Joshua chapter 12. These are not nearly so explanatory as they just happen to be listed. Joshua 12 and verse 4, Og the king of Bashan and his territory, listing all of the ones who had been conquered. And Og the king of Bashan, his territory, who was one of the remnants of the giants. All right. And then Joshua chapter 13 and verse 12. All the kingdom of Og in Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth and Edrei, who remained of the remnant of the giants. So, again, these are just passing references. Joshua chapter 17 and verse 15. Joshua answered them, if you are a great people, then go up to the forest country and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you. So these are probably what were called earlier the Anakim, children of the Anakim, or Anak. Chapter 18, verse 16. Then the border came down to the end of the mountain that lies before the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is the valley of the Rephaim in the north, descended to the valley of Hinnom to the east side and the Jebusite city, excuse me, trying to sneeze, and descended to En-Rogel. All right, well, all of these are places where these two words appear. Nephilim, twice. Rephaim, all of these passages that we've looked at. Now, there is another word, Gibor, that is found in the Old Testament and used in several passages, but it's never referring to height generally as more reputation. These were mighty men. They did great deeds. I guess they could have been tall, but they were not necessarily so. It is more the reputation under consideration in the term mighty than their height. So basically then, we have two words in the Hebrew language that are translated giants, Nephilim and Rephaim. And so now what we want to do is return to Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Because there is a popular teaching in the world, the religious world, that the daughters of men intermarried with angels, called the sons of God, and they had giants as their offspring. That's the popular teaching that there is. If you read some denominational commentaries or talk to some people in denominations, they will often bring this up. I even had a course in Old Testament literature. Well, actually, it was ancient literature. It included the Old Testament as well as plays by Sophocles and Euripides and others. But nevertheless, this was presented even in that class, which really surprised me since the teacher had been a former elder in the Lord's church. But this is how popular this idea has become. So, angels intermarrying with women, the offspring become giants. So that prompts a question. What does the combination of, if that happens, if angels marrying with women produces giants, how do we explain pygmies and midgets? Is that humans marrying with dwarf demons? That makes no sense. That is not a good explanation. When God created human beings, He created some genes that were dominant and some that were recessive. Over a period of time, eventually, all kinds of combinations for height are going to occur. Now, generally, most of those are going to fall within a certain range. But occasionally, some are going to be way tall, and some are going to be way short. Over a period of time, these things occasionally do occur, and they're still occurring, as with the picture of the tall family that we had a few moments ago. Now, if we're going to argue that angels and humans produced tall people, then we're going to have to ask the question, what angels would these be? They could not be the good angels who had not joined Satan in his rebellion against God. They can't be those. Nor could they be the wicked angels, because they were cast down to hell, to Tartarus. Let's notice 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4, we read these words. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell. Now, hell sometimes is the grave, and hell sometimes is eternal fire. One of those words is Hades, and one is Gehenna. This is not either one of those words. They were cast down to hell. The word there is the word Tartarus. They were cast down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. That doesn't really seem like there's a lot of room for them to be running around on earth marrying women, does it? Verse 9 of the same passage says that the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. So they are under punishment. They are not roaming around on earth having tall children. That's just not the way the Bible presents those angels who have fallen. Besides, what kind of punishment would it be for God who to punish angels by casting them out of heaven and then letting them come to earth and live as human beings? That's a punishment? What kind of a punishment would that be? Would they begin a phase of mortality when they came on earth and begin to die? Or would they be allowed numerous incarnations? Well, both of these have problems with them too. Jesus taught, first of all, that spirit beings do not engage in marriage. Matthew chapter 22 and verse 30. But if they were allowed to live as humans and die, then where did the demons come from in the New Testament? And if they were allowed numerous incarnations, then why did they eventually die out? Why do they disappear after a period of time? But this problem is insurmountable. They are not allowed, they do not engage in marriage. So, how do we explain Genesis 6, 1 through 4, if we're going to discount this popular religious theory that some have? I think the explanation for this text begins in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4. And you might think that's a strange place to start, but that's where we're going to start. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and though through it he being dead still speaks. Now notice that he obtained witness. This was proof to anybody who looks at the situation that Abel was righteous and his brother evil. So he would have carried on the righteous seed line, and there was a seed line that developed through whom Christ came. He would have been the head of that seed line, except his brother murdered him. So let's see what happened after that in Genesis chapter 4, verses 25 and 26. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. The righteous seed line that Abel represented and would have developed had he not been murdered by his brother, he was replaced with Seth. Notice it again. The Lord has appointed me another seed for me instead of Cain. Abel was the righteous seed. Now Seth has been appointed as the righteous seed. Then notice verse 26. And as for Seth, to him also was born a son, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. Well, there are a couple of things that we find in this passage. This verse indicates that Seth was the specific replacement for Abel. No other children, the second thing is, no other children who had been born to Adam and Eve had been calling on God. It was not until Seth was born that men began to call on God, which indicates wickedness on the part of all the others. Now, in chapter 5, we have the beginning of one of the genealogies that everybody loves to study, but they're there for a purpose. And in Genesis chapter 5, let's notice verses 1 through 3, what we're looking at in this genealogy. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female, and blessed them, and called them mankind in the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness after his image, and named him Seth. So what do we see with regard to that? It is Seth's line, the righteous seed line, that is now delineated in chapter 5. And we see that Seth was made in Adam's likeness. That's interesting. The only other time we have heard that is Adam and Eve being made in God's likeness. So what does it mean when it says that Seth was made in Adam's likeness? Number one, I would suggest that this shows that Adam had repented of his previous sin and was living righteously, because he was made in God's image, and Seth, the righteous replacement, is made in Adam's image. And so that would indicate that Adam had repented and was living righteously, and that his other children were not following in his ways. Now we want to come to this passage and say a few more things about it. So Adam has apparently repented of his sins, his other children not following his ways, And the genealogy here in Genesis 5 begins with Adam and Seth, and it contains only the children in this line. And it ends with Noah and his three sons in verse 32. So what we have is the development of the righteous seed line. And we know at least one in that line was righteous, because Enoch walked with God 300 years and was not, about verses 22 through 24, for God took him. So we know that this is the righteous seed line. It is the line following in the ways of Adam, following in the way of Seth, following in the ways of Adam, following in the ways of God at this particular time. Now, having seen that genealogy, let's go to Genesis 6, 1 through 4. The sons of God refer to Seth's godly seed line. By the way, how could fallen angels be described as the sons of God? If the theory is that fallen angels intermarried with women, why are they not called formerly the sons of God? That would be the wrong phrase to describe fallen angels, don't you think? And in fact, I can't think of any place in the entire Bible where fallen angels are called sons of God. And so that's another problem with that theory. Now, over the centuries, or over a period of time, the godly seed line had separated from the ungodly seed line, possibly for purity reasons. If you want to keep something pure, you don't intermingle with that which is impure. And so the others were ungodly. They didn't call on the name of the Lord, but Seth and his seed line did. And so over a period of time, however, the godly seed line began to intermarry with the daughters of men, describing the children of everybody else who was not godly. Thus, you have a mixture of the gene pools. And since they had been somewhat separated and there hadn't been an intermingling, it's possible that when they did, the right things came together to produce giants in earth. The two genetic pools began to intermix. They had been separated, and it led to giants. The recessive genes came to the forefront, and you have that odd mixture that produces the giants that were born on the earth prior to the flood. Now, after the flood, the recessive genes again made the right combination, and various groups of giants resulted: the Anakim, the Emim, the Zam, Zumim. Now, having provided an alternate explanation against the popular theory, what is a good principle from this passage? It is always good to apply biblical principles when choosing a mate. And we want to look at a couple of things that emphasize that. This is just a practical application of the passage we've been studying. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 through 4. What did God command Israel to do when they came out of Egypt? Well, let's begin reading. When the Lord our God brings you into the land to which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. What is God saying here? No intermingling. Now, he doesn't reference Genesis 6, 1 through 4, but it's a repetition of the same thing. I don't want you to mix these two lines. You have a pure line, and the nations around you do not. And if you mix these two, you'll end up being idolaters, which, by the way, is precisely what happened. Let's also look at Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 26, that we studied just a bit ago. Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused him to sin. This was the sin of intermarriage with those who were idolaters. The very thing specified in the law, which Solomon surely knew, from Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 4 that we just read. Nevertheless, he took many pagan wives, and they turned his heart away from the Lord. And why is Nehemiah mentioning this? Because some of the Israelites, having been released from captivity, had come back to the land and were marrying idolaters again. Do not intermingle with these people. Do not marry those who reject the true God and who worship idols. And so that's why we find these warnings. There are some other principles that might apply. For example, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. Evil company. That's the problem of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. That's the problem of Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 4. That's the mistake that Solomon made. And there are many, many, many other passages. One comes to mind, the very first psalm that we also talked about just a few weeks ago. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. And you might include dates that individual or marries that individual. That would be as close a tie as is possible and would violate the spirit of this passage. Or even Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 20 deals with this principle. He who walks with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools will be destroyed. You might paraphrase that and say, he who marries a foolish woman shall be destroyed, or she who marries a foolish man will be destroyed. Don't have this intermingling. Look at what happened as a result of it. We read Genesis 6, 1 through 4. What we did not read is Genesis 6 and verse 5. This is the result of the sons of God, the righteous seed line, intermarrying with the daughters of men, the ungodly seed line. Here's the result. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And this led to the destruction of the world through the flood. Surely, we can benefit from the principle that we see in this passage. But these are the words that are translated giants. There is an explanation for how they came to be. But the idea that these were angels certainly has no evidence from the scriptures. This was the righteous seed line intermarrying the ungodly seed line. This evening, hopefully you are choosing your influences wisely. If not, you should repent and get some better influences in your life, and particularly those that you associate with the most. You need to have wise people that you're associating with. You need to be associating with the godly, not the ungodly, or be tempted to participate in the ungodly activities that they would desire of you. If you are not a child of God, possibly this has been your influence your whole life, that of ungodliness. But there is a better way. There is the way of God. There is the way of Christ. There is the way of salvation. And the way to that is through repentance on your part. Repenting of sins, being buried with Christ in baptism so that his blood can wash away all your sins. If you are subject to the invitation or have need of repentance, we invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.